Okay, before we officially start.
Yeah.
You have to think of a happy.
I already have my happy.
Oh, wow. You are better than I am, so.
Attaboy. I came up with an... Wait, no, I have to do it now?
No, we'll do it in a sec.
Oh, okay.
All right. Get your mouth sounds out of the way now.
I had to not spit that. Like, it was a funny idea in my mind, and I was going to laugh too hard at my own joke and spit all over your computer.
Yeah.
And the cat. So I'm glad I didn't do that.
That sounds about right.
Do you want me to introduce you? Hey, everybody, that's Anastasia.
Not when it's like that passive-aggressive sounding. Jesus.
A little vicious. I got to laugh away from the mic, too. My little spiky things are getting too big in the screen.
Oh, you can just watch that. Okay, well, it's also because my little spikies are very, very tiny.
I know.
Because I don't have a big man voice.
You gotta project. That's like...
Like, I have not projected a day in my life other than screaming when I fall off the horse.
I feel like there's a tequila joke in there somewhere, too, but I'm not gonna make it. Project.
Oh.
Yeah, oh. That's why it was gross.
That's gross.
Yeah, but you looked at me questioningly, so I had to finish it at that point.
Well, yeah, because I was referencing being loud, not vomitous.
Too many syllables.
Ugh. Gross.
Vomitous. So, we should probably start at some point.
Yeah, we should. Everyone, this is Anastasia.
And this is Blake.
You're listening to Wait to Panic, a podcast where two friends take turns trying to scare one another shitless. And this week, Lauren is on break, so I've got Blake here with me.
That was a long stare. I didn't have anything prepped for that. I thought we were still going.
No, that was pretty much it. You're my Lauren.
I'm excited to be back. I'm excited to be fake Lauren this week.
Fake Lauren.
This is number three?
Number three.
I'm excited to see what we do for number three. Are we bringing back drugs?
No.
No drugs in this one.
No, just lots of murder.
Lots of murder. Okay. I mean, there's opportunity there. Anything's better than the creepy kids from last time.
I mean, you say that.
I did. All right. Is there going to be as many, like, bad band references in this one?
No. There is a band, but it's not good.
The band
might have been good, but what happens to a member of the band is not good.
Okay, good clarifying up front.
Yeah. Also, quick preface, if you hear the undertones of a cat purring, we have our kitten in here with us because he just got neutered and we don't trust him by himself. And the bed is his favorite place and he's very happy.
He is. I think the cone amplifies the noise, so I've got him pointed away.
I mean, you can still hear it.
Yeah. So I did think today of a murder show that I think I would be interested in watching.
Oh, yeah?
Yes. If there was a murder show that was produced and written by the same folks that do Letterkenny, I would be on board.
I would also watch that.
If you put the same cast in it, I on board immediately.
Oh, yeah. Sign me
up. I was thinking about that today because the new season of Letterkenny started today on Hulu.
Oh.
Yeah, day after Christmas.
I like it.
Yeah, I'm excited.
All right, so really quick, what's your happy?
Today, my happy is that we had really good jumps today.
We did.
We were writing. And
we had good jumpy boys.
Like, I was Princess Jasmine, and Jupiter was my Aladdin, and he showed me the world. Just flew. It was great. I guess that more appropriately was a Steely Dan Magic Carpet Ride
that reference. Was.
But...
Yeah, I would prefer the Steely Dan, but...
Yeah.
You do you, boo.
Yeah, you know. Gotta dig deep on those. It was good, though.
Good. Let's see. My happy is that Blake's drinking coffee.
The jumping was good. It was still tiring.
Yeah. No, we are, like, so far into want-to-take-a-nap territory, but it's also 6:30 at night, so that's really just a pre-sleep.
Digging deep.
No, I would say that my happy is... I'm really happy to be on break still. Like,
right.
So glad to be coming up on Sunday and still having another week of whatever I want to do. And Yeah, super excited for it.
What are we doing?
Whatever we want to do.
Perfect. Make that hot sauce.
That sounds like a good idea. So, to segue right into the terrible, you ready to talk about murder?
I mean, I suppose. I got a cat, I've got coffee, murder seems appropriate.
Interesting.
Sorry, I still haven't gotten over the last time I was on this, and so many cats died.
So many cats did die. Yeah.
Maybe that's why we have another one now, it was just repressed.
Yeah, maybe. He was also really cute and sleeping in our planners.
Yeah, fair enough.
But murder. So, have you ever heard, I already know the answer's going to be no, but I have to ask, have you ever heard of the Texarkana murders?
No. Although part of me wants to just say yes and shut down the whole thing right up front.
Oh, no, we'd still talk about it because I know you're lying.
Yeah, that's fair.
So, what about the Phantom Killer?
Unless it was in an opera, I've got nothing.
It's not, but, the story of the hook-handed man?
Only from SpongeBob. I'm pretty sure it was a spatula, so check your facts.
It was also on Supernatural, so bitch please.
Oh, actually, yes! I do recall that now that you say that.
Yeah.
Ooh, the Supernatural reference.
There's no reference to Supernatural in this one, but this is where the urban legend may have started.
I'm disappointed now.
Well, you're probably going to be more disappointed. So I know murder is not usually your interest or your forte.
It's really not.
But that's what I got this week.
All right. So, well, I will buckle in and keep sipping my coffee that is definitely just coffee.
Is it just coffee?
No. I knew we're talking about murder. Of course it's not just coffee.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. So in Texas, there is a little town that hugs the border between Texas and Arkansas. Which still bothers me how Arkansas is spelled and pronounced two entirely different ways. But, whatever. Naturally, they called it Texarkana, or Texarkana. I don't really know.
Kind of like the SeaTac of the South.
Yeah, but full of, SeaTac also has murder, so. Whatever.
It works on multiple levels.
Yep. So, thanks to a 1976 horror film, it is also nicknamed The Town That Dreaded Sundown.
Is that Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Or...
Yeah, kinda.
Don't know the movie.
So, the film was also called that, but it's based loosely on a series of local murders, and really they're just as bad as anything you would see on a movie screen. And unfortunately, all truly, truly creepy ones, nearly 70 years later, it's still unsolved. They don't have any hard, fast culprit for who was behind it all.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, known as the Texarkana Moonlight Murders, or the Phantom Killer / Slayer Murders, this case absolutely horrified this little town, which, to be fair, I feel like is what everyone says, but there you go.
I feel like Texas is, little town Texas is the more gory version of small town Maine.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's Stephen King could write some books there if he ever relocated.
I think it's more of who's the dude who does all the blood? Tarantino. It's like a Tarantino Ooh. Town.
All right. Such a happy kitten. So the thing that got me about this story is it feels like it should be an urban legend. This is where the hook-handed man and all that kind of came from. The bunny man and all that. But it's real.
Never heard it called the Bunny Man.
No, the Bunny Man, the legend of Bunny Man Bridge.
Oh, no, talking about Bridge. See, the only Bunny Man I know is from Donnie Darko, and that's a weird...
Oh, yeah, that's a whole other thing.
Whole different thing.
Yeah, kind of.
I don't how many, things are connecting here.
Yeah. Well, sorry. But, yeah, this whole story feels like it should be an urban legend and not true. But unfortunately it is, and I'm sorry. This unknown killer did actually leave some of his victims alive, and one of them was definitely unintentionally left alive. The first two, he just let them go for whatever reason. But the third left aliver was very, very lucky. But there were 8 people total attacked, with a possible 9th, and it took place over a 10-week period before everything just went radio silent, and that was the last that they ever heard of it. So, he was described, and I do say he because that's, like, the best description that 2 of the people could give, was that it was a man. But they described him as wearing a white mask or a sack with holes cut out for the eyes. Which, if that doesn't belong in a B-movie, I don't know what does. A
little bit.
So, between February 22nd, 1946 and May 3rd, 1946, at least 5 people died and... at least 5 people. Yeah, okay, 5 people died, 8 people were attacked. 3 of them, the 3 people survived. 5 who died, 8. Math is not my strong suit. It's been a long day.
Well, they don't really do that class in college, murder math.
forensic science? I don't know. But almost every 3 weeks on the dot, he claimed another set of victims, which were always couples. Which, again, the reference to the hook-handed man. But we're going to start off with our first pair, which is a bit of a warm fuzzy, I guess. It's pretty lukewarm, not going to lie, but it's like the one bright spot in this story. And so it starts off with Jimmy Hollis and Mary... It rhymes. I'm sorry. I'm going to laugh about it every time. But Mary Larry.
What kind of last name is that?
I don't know. It's her last name.
Larry is not a last name.
She didn't get to pick it, Blake.
Somebody should have a word with that family line.
It could be Larry, but that's not much better.
It's got a U in it?
No, it's just Larrey.
Oh.
Mary Larry.
Yeah, I mean...
There's no other way to say that I could think of.
No, you're right. All right. Proceed.
Yep. So the only reason I say it's kind of a warm fuzzy is because these were the first 2 victims and they survived.
Oh.
And it goes downhill after this, but Jimmy Hollis, he's 25 and Mary was 19. They were a young couple that had gone out in the town looking for some privacy. They had just seen a movie and had gone down one of the lovers' lanes side roads. So
this sounds exactly like that Supernatural episode.
Right. Well, it's going to sound a lot like that for a bit, but with less blood painted on the... Well, fuck no. Okay. You know, we're just going to go. So yeah, they went down a Lover's Lane Road on February 22nd, roughly 50 feet off of Robinson Road. And this person comes up to them, shines a flashlight through the window, and they found themselves at gunpoint. They were about 100 yards from a row of houses that sat on the outskirts of town, and it was just before midnight when they were approached. So this guy comes up to the driver's side window, and Jimmy goes, "Hey man, you've got the wrong person," thinking that they were looking for someone. And I assume he rolled down the window to talk to him, but the individual responded, "I don't want to kill you, fellow, so just do what I say." And orders them out of their car, which I don't... There was no real good course of action for Jimmy to take here. So, yeah, they get out of the car. And he basically tells Jimmy to just drop trow and goes, quote, "Take off your goddamn britches." And then proceed to basically beat the ever-loving shit out of Jimmy to the point where his skull fractured.
Oh.
Yeah. So Mary later said that the 2 blows Jimmy took to the head were so loud she thought he had been shot, but it was really just the sound of his skull fracturing. Mary rightfully panicked, thought he was there to rob them, and showed him Jimmy's wallet to prove there's no money in it. The phantom hit her with a blunt object and told her to stand up and then run. So she runs towards a ditch initially, only to be ordered by him to stop and change directions, which...
I mean, I would... That's...
Yeah.
I feel like you're winning.
Yeah. But, yeah, he told her to run towards the road. So she does. And as she's running, she sees an old car that's parked on the side of the road. and runs up to it, hoping that there's someone inside, but it's empty. So at this point, the Phantom catches up to her and asks her why she was running. When she told him that he had ordered her to run, he called her a liar and really sorry, sexually assaults her with the pistol he had threatened them with.
Jesus.
I said I was sorry, okay? It's a murder story. It's not going to be good. Nothing about it is good. When he was done, he just let her leave, and so she ran nearly half a mile to the nearest house before she was able to wake someone up to call the police. So she phoned the police, and back at the car, Jimmy has finally woken up, and he managed to flag down a passerby on Richmond Road. The driver left Jimmy there at the scene and drove to a nearby funeral home, where he then also called the police. 30 minutes later, the Bowie County Sheriff, Bill Presley, and three of his officers arrived at the scene, but obviously by this point the attacker had fled. So Jimmy's pants, they were found 100 yards from the car. Mary was hospitalized overnight for her head wound, and Jimmy stayed there for several days to recover from his multiple skull fractures. Unfortunately, the two were able to, or were unable to give non-conflicting evidence. Mary claimed that their attacker had a white bag over his head with cutouts for the eyes, and said she could see that he was African American. Jimmy, on the other hand, claimed that the man was white, albeit darkly tanned, and was roughly 30 years old, but then also said he couldn't see any features through the light of the flashlight. Both of them did agree that the attacker was around 6 feet tall, but the police suspected that Mary may have known the person and that her and Jimmy were basically covering for said individual, which if you know them and he does that to you with a pistol, don't cover for him.
Or, you know, beats your skull in or yeah. Literally any of that.
Yeah, like none of that. Don't cover for that person. So, yep, Jimmy and Mary, they are her first couple attacked, and luckily they live to tell the tale. They both went on to live moderately long lives, I guess. I think Mary died of cancer at like 40, and Jimmy passed away in his sleep when he was in his mid-50s. So they continued on with their lives afterwards, but most of the others that we have here were not so lucky.
Well, geez, after an intro like that, I sure am hooked.
You're so funny.
Uh-huh.
So our next two take place almost exactly 3 weeks after the first one, and it was also a couple down a lover's lane looking for some privacy. So in March, Richard Griffin and Polly Ann Moore were found dead in their car at the end of a secluded road. They had only been dating about 6 weeks and had just gotten done with dinner with Richard's sister and her boyfriend the night that they were attacked. Richard was 29 and a war veteran who went on to make a living as a carpenter and a painter, and he was found with a bullet in the back of his head. Polly was only 17, which...
Sketch.
But whatever. She was living in a boarding house with her cousin, and she was also found shot in the back of her head. So on March 24th, between 8:30 and 9 a.m., a passing driver saw a parked car on Rich Road near a railroad spur roughly 100 yards south of U.S. Highway 67 West near a nightclub named Club Dallas. Real creative, guys. At first, the driver thought Richard was just asleep, which I'm going to give the position that he was sleeping in, and I don't know who sleeps like this, but if I saw that, that would not be my assumption that the person was sleeping. He was resting between the front seats on his knees with his head resting on his crossed hands and his pockets were turned out.
Yeah, no, that, like, not that, even a little.
No, that is not something that says that person's taken a nap to me. So Polly, she was sprawled face down in the back seat, and there was evidence that she was killed on a blanket outside the vehicle. There was a blood-soaked patch of earth that was near the car that suggested the pair had been killed outside and then moved back into the car. There was congealed blood found on the running board, suggesting that it had flowed through the bottom of the car door where Richard kneeled, and there was a .32 caliber bullet found wrapped in the blanket that was determined belonging to a Colt pistol.
That really narrows it down.
Right, yeah. You know, a very common gun at the time. So, with these first two set of attacks, there was a police report, or a police reward posted. On March 30th, there was a reward posted for $500 up the stakes there, for anything that would lead to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons responsible. But nothing came of it. There were over 100 false leads provided, and the police ultimately had no answers for their increasingly desperate public.
Do you know how, like, doctors have those, what are they called? The people who think they're sick all the time?
Hypochondriacs?
Yeah, doctors have hypochondriacs. Do you think police have, like, the regulars? People who are constantly trying to turn in their neighbors and stuff?
Yes, and this whole thing really spiked that in the town. Like, it turned into a whole town of people like that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I can imagine, like, it's, you know, a small town being maybe 1,000 people or something.
Maybe.
And just, you have Barry over there, who every time something gets put out there, he's like, he calls, I know it's Jeff, it's gonna be Jeff, it has to be Jeff, I saw him, he mowed his lawn backwards, that's gotta be, yeah.
Yeah. By the time the third set of victims comes around, the town is basically, like, fever pitch, ready to implode on each other.
Not a lot of tourism happening there.
Definitely not. A lot of exodus, though.
Yeah.
So, yep, we've got a police reward now. So, a couple weeks go by again with nothing. The public now had a pretty solid inkling that there was someone attacking, and they were at large. So, yeah. People are scared shitless, rightfully so. I don't know of many towns at that time, or even now, that would handle that well. But yeah, they started setting curfews for businesses. The residents basically armed themselves to the teeth with whatever they could find. Stores were sold out of guns, ammo, lock, just about any kind of, like,
security type thing.
Yeah, like, they went, like, what do you call it when you, like, rig up those super ridiculous homemade, like, the Home Alone style traps.
Oh, I get what you're saying.
Yeah, that's basically what this whole town did.
They booby-trapped the entire town.
Booby-trapped everything they could. They had people who...
Well, good on them, though. I mean, like, what a sense of community.
Yeah. Little much, though. So I've also linked in the FBI vaults. They did finally release the records for all this, and there's some stories in there. I do have one of the more humorous ones at the very end, which I know will make you chuckle.
I hope so.
But yeah, people basically barricaded themselves into their homes, and, like, if women's husbands who were well off enough went out of town for work, like, they just loaded their kids up into the car and went and stayed at the hotel, which, interestingly, is called the Grimm Hotel.
What is wrong with this town?
I don't know if I would have stayed there, but they did. Because I guess the hotel was safer than just being home alone, which I don't...
Speaking of which, I just learned about a fun fact today.
Oh, yeah?
There used to be a profession called hotel detectives.
Oh.
Do you know about these?
I did not.
They were, like, ex-police, usually, hired by the hotels, and their whole job was investigating, like, the people the hotel hired, and then investigating the hotel clients. They weren't really there to stop crimes from being committed, except in the case of the hotel staff. They're making sure, like, they weren't stealing, like, silverware and stuff. So
they were basically just, like, a background check?
Sort of. They're, like, the big thing that they were about was back when it used to be illegal for non-married couples to stay together. The hotel didn't want the reputation that they were a place where that was happening.
Gotcha.
And so they kept track of everybody who was bringing back, like, prostitutes and things like that.
Sex workers.
Sex workers, I'm quoting. And then, because apparently the successful sex workers would take the money and the wallet and like hotel linens and all sorts of stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. I mean, Enterprise where you can.
I mean, you respect the hustle, but anyway, yeah, that was my alert about that today.
Interesting. I'm going to have to look into that.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, people would go, Cal is so happy. So full of the squiggles.
Ooh, sweat.
Rage. So yeah, people would go stay in hotels if like their husbands went out of town, yada yada. Big surprise, a lot of the young men in town had that youthful bravado and basically were like, we're gonna fucking find him and beat him, and they would go like patrol the lovers' lanes in the hopes of running into this person. And I don't know what their thought was when they finally got them. I'm just picturing
like a bunch of frat guys in Letterman jackets with baseball bats.
Well, it wasn't just the guys, though, because there, one of the stories I remember was there was a car that was pulled off to the side of the road, and a police officer had rolled up to it. And really, Cal? but yeah, the police had gone up to it, and by this point, at the end of the summer, like, they were, it was almost as bad as it is to be a police officer right now for them. Like, they literally had to, like, get out of the car, announce themselves. If it was night, they had to stand, like, where the headlights could see and, like, say, hey, I'm a police officer, here's my badge, we're gonna have a talk. And so he did that one night to what ended up being a young lady. And she's like, basically told him, hey, you know, it's a good thing that you announced yourself, because he's like, hey, don't you know it's dangerous to be alone by yourself out here? She's like, no, I think I'm okay. And like, just moves her arm, and she had a fucking gun pointed at him. So yeah, no, it was just a town full of people who were ready.
They're on it. Like, if there's a town that's going to survive the zombie apocalypse, it's gonna apparently be Texas. This place.
Yeah.
And they're already set up in the Grim Hotel, so you know.
Just terrible name for a hotel. So yeah, 3 more weeks have gone by, and
I hear the service is to die for.
I hate you and love you at the same time.
There's more coming, I'm sure.
Yeah. So yeah, 3 weeks go by, and then there's 2 more victims. So April 13th, Paul Martin, who was 17, and Betty Jo Booker was 15, and they were both found dead. Betty would be the youngest victim claimed here, and Paul and Betty had only been dating for a few weeks. They'd known each other since kindergarten and finally gotten together when this happened. She was playing in a band, did I write down what they were called? Yes, okay. She was playing her alto sax at the Veterans of Foreign War Club, and the band was called the Rhythmers.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, I thought you'd like it. But it was on, not that you know the street names, I don't know the street names, but it was West 4th and Oak Street.
That one's for you, Texas. If you know where it is, give us a shout.
I doubt it's still there, but who knows. So Paul came to pick her up at around 1:30 in the morning. And when she was done, it was a weekly gig. And so he came to pick her up, and that was the last time that they were seen. So fast forward 5 hours, Paul's body is found. It's about 6:30 in the morning, and Mr. and Mrs. Weaver and their son find Paul lying on his left side at the northern edge of North Park Road. Further down the road, there's blood evidence that's found. Paul was shot 4 times, once through the nose, the left 4th rib from behind, the right hand, and then finally through the back of the neck. Betty wasn't found for 6 more hours. She was over 2 miles away from Paul, and at 11:30 in the morning, she was found behind a tree by families, members of the Boyd family, along with their family friend, Ted Shopley, who joined in the search party. She was found fully clothed, lying on her back, with her right hand in the pocket of her buttoned overcoat. She was shot 2, once in the chest and once in the face, which I don't know why the face shooting is always so cringy to me, but that one always bothers me. But they determined that the weapon was the same. It was a .32 automatic Colt pistol. know why they say automatic, but whatever.
Yeah, I mean...
I mean, it's a pistol.
We can go into that another time.
Yeah. So, Paul's Ford Club coupe was found over 3 miles from where Betty's body was, and 1.5 miles from where Paul was found. It was parked outside of Spring Lake Park, with the keys still inside. Authorities were unable to determine which of the pair had been shot first, which, I mean, my first guess is probably Paul, because that seems to be the MO, is he gets the guy and then tells the girl to run.
Seems like it.
But yeah, so Sheriff Presley and his whole precinct, they were joined by the Texas Rangers.
Okay.
Which I didn't realize those were still a thing.
Still a thing or were a thing?
Well, I didn't realize they were still a thing like into the 90s. I don't know if they're still a thing now, to be honest.
How long did you think Chuck Norris's show went?
I never watched it.
I
have a vague idea of who Chuck Norris is, mostly through memes, and
well,
that's it.
Walker Texas Ranger is the one.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not up on pop culture, clearly.
Right. Fair enough.
There was one famous captain, which those of you who know anything about the Texas Rangers will probably recognize. I didn't know he was famous. I know nothing about him.
Not from Texas.
Yeah. But he was Captain M.T., quote, Lone Wolf Gonzalez. He reported to the little town of Texarkana and brought his whole crew with them and joined the case. And they stayed there pretty much for like 6 months before they just trickled out of town. But
roll in all hot and stuff and then just leave.
Pretty much. They examined both the bodies and saw that the pair had most likely fought pretty hard against whoever their assailant was. Obviously, that didn't pay off for them, but yeah, they at least tried. Betty's saxophone was unable to be located at the scene, and it actually wasn't found for another 6 months, which, a little suspicious. October 24th was when it was found, still in its imitation leather case in the underbrush near where Betty had been found.
Kind of
weird. So at this point, the reward increases from $500 to $1,700, which back in the 40s, that was some money. I mean, that's still some money now, but...
Yeah, but that's like, you know, tens of thousands of dollars now.
Yeah, well, it goes up. So at this point, rumors are running wild through town. People are pointing the finger at one another, just left and right. There's some speculation that a local minister had turned in his son as a suspect, and Captain Gonzalez had to actually issue a statement that basically said, look, we don't have a suspect in custody. Stop speculating because you're harming innocent people. Like,
wow.
Stop being assholes. We're trying to solve a crime here. So, another 3 weeks go by until the first week of May, and on May 3rd, the last two of the Phantom's official victims are attacked, and it's a husband and wife. So, northeast of Texarkana, Katie and Virgil Starks made their home on their farm. Virgil was 39, he was a farmer and a welder, he had a little welding shop and everything. And shortly before 9 p.m., he had settled down in his favorite armchair to tune into his favorite weekly radio show, which I find it funny that radio shows have just turned into podcasts now. But
I thought you were going a whole different direction with that. I thought you were telling me that his favorite radio show was The Phantom.
That would be horrible and ironic.
The peak of irony there.
Yeah.
Which, fun Blake fact, I used to listen to those. Used to be a radio station in Spokane, AM radio station that after 7 o'clock would play old radio plays.
Yeah.
Which is why I have that reference. There is actually one called The Phantom.
Huh. I just know my mom used to listen, like, back in the 90s when they would broadcast, like, The Young and the Restless and all those, like, soap operas on the radio.
Back when they used to just play TV through the radio.
Yeah, pretty much. So that was like a radio show to me because I didn't realize it was a TV show.
I'm kind of sad they stopped doing that.
Right?
Used to be nice. I'd listen to some radio shows.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, Virgil has just settled down to listen to his favorite weekly show. And Katie, who's, I'm just going to throw it in, she's 36. Better age gaps here. She goes to give him his electric heating pad. Didn't know those were a thing already. Like, I always just imagine it was like the hot water bottle or heated pads, but...
I'm curious what the insulation on that looked like.
I am too. I'm going to say based on what happens later that it's not great. Yeah. So she gives him his heating pad for his back because he's a farmer and a welder and his back hurts. Shocker.
I don't think you need to be any of those things to enjoy that.
Yeah. So the sitting room where Virgil was, it sat just off of the kitchen and the bedroom. And so Katie went to her bedroom, because back then you had separate bedrooms, apparently. And she went to go to bed and was lying there when she heard something in the backyard. So hearing that, she goes and asks Virgil to turn down the radio, saying, "Hey, I think I heard something." So a second later, two shots were fired into the back of his head.
Oh.
Yeah. Katie heard the sound of breaking glass, but not the shots themselves. So she thought that Virgil had just dropped something. And when she got up to go check on them, she saw him stand up and then immediately slump back into his chair and then saw all the blood. So she ran to him and lifted up his head and immediately saw that he was dead. And honestly, Katie is a badass because... holy shit. Just hang with me through this. So, sees her husband's dead. She goes to run to the phone to call the police, manages to ring through twice before she's shot in the face twice from the same window that Virgil was shot through. So the breaking glass she heard was the bullet going through the window.
Mm-hmm.
But the first bullet, it goes through her right cheek and exits just behind her left ear. And the second goes in just below her lip, breaks her jaw, splinters a bunch of her teeth, and lodges under her tongue.
Oh.
Yeah. Understandably, falls to her knees, but like a true champ, she fucking rallies. And she gets up, and she runs to get the pistol from the living room.
Texas.
Yep. Yeah. But she's blinded by her own blood.
Yeah.
So she can't find it. So... she says, fuck that. She hears the sound of whoever the killer is tearing loose the rusted wire screen on the back porch. And rightfully thinking, evidence has proved that she was supposed to be next. Katie gets her ass in gear. And so she stumbles to the bedroom in the front of the house to leave a note. Like, had the presence of mind to be like,
is this lady?
I don't know. I don't know what she wrote on the note, but whatever. So, whoever the attacker was, he ran to the back of the house and made his way up the steps and through the side screen back porch, and he was basically ripping through the rusted wire there. So, Katie hears him coming through the kitchen window and runs through the dining room, through the bedroom, down the hallway, through another bedroom, and through the living room, and finally out the front door, leaving a, quote, virtual river of blood and teeth behind her.
Ugh.
Yeah, she runs across the street in a bloody nightgown, totally barefoot, to where her sister and brother-in-law lived.
Yeah.
No one was home.
Oh, bad luck.
Katie's not done.
Okay.
She runs another 50 yards to A.V. Prater's house. And so he answers, again, it's 9 o'clock at night. Most people are getting ready for bed.
Uh-huh.
So he answers the door after she starts pounding on it, manages to gasp, "Virgil's dead," and then collapses. Prater gets the next MVP award because he steps up and just goes immediately into action. I'm assuming he had a gun near the front door or maybe had it already in hand.
Texas.
Also, they've had, like, 4 people murdered, so they're already a little on edge.
Yeah, I mean, nothing against anyone in this story. They're making the appropriate choices here.
Yeah, so he fires a rifle into the air, shouts for his neighbor, Elmer Taylor, and he tells Elmer to bring the car. Mr. and Mrs. Starks have been shot. So Elmer, along with both Mr. and Mrs. Prater and their newborn baby, which...
You know what you bring to a knife fight? A gun. You know what you bring to the gunfight? A baby.
Yeah, so they load Katie up into the car and take her to Michael Meagher Hospital, which is now Miller County Health Unit. Katie gave Elmer, who was driving, one of her teeth that had a gold filling in it, which I just imagine someone, like, who's been shot twice through the face handing you that, and it is horrifying.
Can this lady be voted president or something? Because, holy cow.
Oh, it gets better. So, she's still pretty conscious at this point, and she's lost a shit ton of blood, but somehow had no signs of going into shock. Like, her blood, like, her pulse was still normal, and she was pretty damn coherent, minus being shot through the face.
Yeah.
So, they've called the police at this point, said, hey, this is what happened, we're taking her to the hospital. The hospital also called the police and said, hey, got a lady here who's been shot twice through the face. We're dealing with it, but you need to go check this out. So, Arkansas State, because again, bordering Texas and Arkansas,
yeah.
The Arkansas State Police officers, Charlie Boyd and Max Tackett, were the first two officers on the scene. And there are some conflicting reports, but neither of them are great, obviously. One said that they found Virgil slumped in a blood-soaked chair, and that the chair had caught on fire from the electric heating pad.
Yep. You know, I was going to make, a heating pad slash electric fire starter joke. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But they said that the smoke was filling the room and coming up all around the man and between his legs. Miller County Sheriff Davis contradicted this, saying when his officers arrived, they found the chair on fire, but Virgil had not been burned because he'd fallen to the floor.
Wow.
So.
Okay. Well.
Either way, the chair's on fire.
Yeah.
So. And Virgil's dead. So the officers who arrived at the scene found what really could be best described as a horror show. They said they found a trail of blood with scattered teeth throughout the house. On the dining room, there were Katie's supplies where she had been making a new dress. And when the Texas Ranger captain saw the blood, he stated, quote, it was beyond him how and why she did not bleed to death. Which, that's a lot of blood. That's a lot of, like, major arteries in this facial region.
It's like all facial wounds bleed a lot. You just got so many...
If you think about, like, the bullet literally going through, like, to exit out behind the ear.
As long as it didn't get the big one.
But it also, like, went... like, into her tongue. Mouth wounds bleed like a bitch.
It's definitely a lot of blood. That's, I don't think anyone's contesting that.
Yeah. Anyway. So, there were two bullet holes found in the window, which led investigators to believe that an automatic rifle had been used. They believed that having shot Virgil, the killer waited outside the window for Katie to appear so he could shoot her as well, which is basically what did happen. They found three clues, which were more than the clues they had found at any of the other scenes. So the first was that the caliber of bullet that was used, which correlated with a rifle. The second was a flashlight found in the hedge under the window where the Starks had been shot. Which I don't know how. Well, if he was facing away from it, obviously, then he wouldn't have seen someone shining a flashlight through the window. So, never mind. The third was bloody footprints around the house, which... shocker. Followed by shoe prints on the kitchen floor, smudge bloody fingerprints in other places. There were straight up like handprints on some of the walls. And again, bloody scene.
Yeah.
They were unwilling to immediately link this killing to the Phantom because of the different caliber of bullet found, but did say that it was possible the killer is one and the same man.
Well, and it's, like, different from the previous ones, right? As in, like, it wasn't teenagers in a car somewhere isolated.
So, we'll get into speculation on that. So, bloodhounds were brought in early Saturday morning from Hope by the Arkansas police. Two trails were found that led them to the highway before they were lost. And throughout the night, officers patrolled as many of the lovers' lanes as they could in the hopes of preventing another killing. They reasoned that... he had been unsuccessful in this one. with the exception, obviously, of Virgil.
And so is it going to try to do it again?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So by Saturday or Sunday night, they had at least 12 suspects in custody, but only kept 3 of them for further questioning. At this point, over 47 officers were working around the clock on this case.
Wow.
Which, I mean, for a little town, that's a lot.
That's all of them.
Yeah, and then some. So they sent the flashlight to D.C. for FBI analysis. And in the meantime, Katie is getting better in the hospital.
Thank God.
By this point, the reward is over $7,000.
Whoa.
Yeah, it bumped up pretty quick between Virgil dying and, like, Tuesday.
Yeah.
Like, in a 3-day period, it skyrocketed. So, by Tuesday, Captain Gonzalez, he called in a mobile radio station, which I didn't realize was a thing.
Yeah.
And a fleet of what they called prowl cars, which were furnished with a 2-way radio. They called those in from Austin, Texas. There was a clerk from the Bowie County Selective Service Board Number 1 who stated that even though he contacted officers 2 weeks prior, no investigating officers had checked his files. And then another clerk from Miller County Draft Board said that there had been no request for examination of her files as well. So both explained that their reports would have revealed information like thumbprints, rifleman wards, mental and physical conditions of the registrants of those guns, yada yada.
Mm-hmm.
But no one had contacted them, so they had nowhere to go with their information.
Thanks, cops.
Yeah. So Tuesday night, during a radio interview, Gonzalez asked residents to investigate or to help the investigation by refraining from spreading blah, 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 and repeating rumors. The next day, the mobile radio transmitting station arrives in Texarkana late in the afternoon, along with 10 police cars and 20 state police officers. And this whole unit is put into operation pretty much immediately. So Saturday, May 11th, a teletype machine arrives from Austin, Texas, in that afternoon, and was installed by that night in the Bowie County Sheriff's Office. Gonzalez explained that the machine would aid in the investigation by connecting them with other law enforcement officials and offices in Texas. Sheriffs Presley and Davis suggested raising a reward fund of $2,500 for information that would help catch the killer of Virgil Starks. They mentioned if the slayer of Mr. Starks was the same killer responsible for the other murders, then the Starks reward would be combined with the others, equating a sum of over $10,000?
Jeez.
Yeah. So over a month later, on Monday, June 10th, Virgil's father, Jack Starks, adds in another $500 reward for information leading to the arrest and conviction of his son's killer.
I mean, at some point, I feel like no matter what the monetary reward is, like, if people, like, continuing in a small town like that, they either have to know who it is or have no idea who it is. And, like, changing the amount of money, I feel like, almost doesn't change the math there.
Yeah, we'll get into that. So further down the road, by November of 1948, authorities no longer considered the Starks murder connected to the others. But based on some other analysis, I think it's connected, personally. But I'm going to include them as his victims. So after the first double murder happened, some parents obviously started to warn their kids about being out late. By the time the second double murder happened, the whole city is completely shocked. You know, like I said, businesses went into curfews, yada yada. But the height of hysteria really hit a fever pitch with Virgil. Before, it had been pretty normal to leave your house unlocked. You know, small town kind of thing.
Mm.
And that changed really quick.
Well, I can imagine.
So residents started locking their doors, pulling down their shades, blocking their windows, and armed themselves with, you know, pretty much, again, whatever they could find. Some people nailed sheets over their windows, nailed the windows down. Some people used screen door braces as window guards, which I wonder if this is where, like, the thing of putting the, like, the dowel in the window.
I always thought that was just, like, good lock-your-house practice.
I did, too, but I never considered it could be because of something like this.
Huh.
So, the day after Virgil Starks died, pretty much all the stores were selling out of their guns, locks, ammo, window shades, Venetian blinds, anything and everything they could to really block off the sight of interior of the house.
Oh.
So additional items that sales saw an increase on were window sash locks, screen door locks, night latches, and pretty much any other protective device.
I can't imagine they had that many to begin with in a town like that.
Probably not. But they described it as the farmhouses and neighborhoods were ablaze with light. Several, Several businesses, including cafes, theaters, nightclubs, all of those, shocker, lost a lot of customers. One business reported a 20% drop in sales. Evenings were fairly busy, but the streets were basically deserted when dawn approached. The city became a lived-in ghost town for the night hours, and because of the drop in business, liquor sales started closing at 9:30 with a statement posted in the paper saying, quote, "We fully understand the state of mind in which Texarkana is now gripped, and we are selling no liquor to persons who have already been drinking. We do not wish to add further to the troubles of the police. Any person who drinks whiskey at this time to get drunk and wander about the streets of Texarkana is further complicating the works of the police and placing himself in grave danger of being shot by people whose nerves are on edge from the recent murders."
Could you imagine if that was, like, the stance of commerce in 2020?
Oh, yeah, no.
I don't think that anybody would have lived, like, yeah, that's a total discussion, but...
Yeah.
Wow.
So, at this point, Texarkana has become a very dangerous place to be.
Yeah.
Mostly, really, not just, like, for neighbor to neighbor, but... for the police officers, they were having a hard time. They had to, when they drove up on someone, they had to turn on their sirens, stand in their headlights, and announce themselves to basically keep from being shot by a nervous homeowner or driver or whoever. In order to go to someone's house, you basically had to call in advance and let them know to expect you. And there was one tavern owner who shot a customer in the foot.
Uh-huh.
Just as the customer was coming in looking for some beer, and it was, like, close to closing time, got shot in the foot.
Yeah.
And this is where it got kind of silly. At one point, there were a bunch of white-faced calves, like cows.
Cows, yeah.
That had gotten loose, and it was around County Avenue, and they'd fallen asleep on some of the people's lawns, and the people, it was dark.
Uh-huh.
So... they called the police to report these white-faced things in the dark. And so, of course, the police officers show up. They're like, they're fucking cows. Like, come on, guys. We have bigger things to deal with right now than shooing cows off your lawns.
Imagine the relief, though.
Oh, yeah.
They start mooing and running away.
Yeah. So, 3 weeks go by, and there's no murders. So, the town... begins to come down a little bit. So the concern lasted throughout the rest of the summer and eventually subsided after 3 months went by of no murders. So after 3 months of silence, the Texas Rangers slowly and quietly trickled out of town. They did it carefully to keep the, quote, phantom from launching another attack of opportunity. But these murders made national and international news. Then in 1948, I didn't realize this was actually another story I had researched for today, but decided ultimately on this one, and I didn't realize it was connected until I got to this one.
Huh.
But in 1948, 21-year-old Virginia Carpenter disappeared from Texarkana and was thought to be one of his victims. So that might have to be one of my follow-up stories. But we'll get into some theories. So there were several theories about who the phantom was. There were theories that because of the attacks being on couples, there were no burglaries or robberies being committed. Like, Katie, when she had fled her house. Like, there was a bunch of money in her purse. She had jewelry out. Mm-hmm. Like, there was plenty of opportunity in him going through the house to grab and run at the same time, and he left it all.
Well, I feel like once your double murder has, turned out to be a single murder and escapee, like, you probably aren't sticking around to rifle through that.
No, but even the others, like, he didn't take jewelry or anything off of any of the bodies. Like, he just left them, like, Richard and them, they had money, and he just left it, like, no one touched the wallets, nothing. And, I don't know, maybe I would say it's, like, they could trace the bills, but it's not like it was a bank robbery, so.
Yeah, I mean, how would you know?
Yeah. But they thought that because it was just couples and there was no robbery involved with it, that the killer was some kind of depraved sex maniac. And despite the Texas Rangers being very heavily involved with this case, there were never any definitive arrests made. They made over 400 arrests in this case, by the way.
That's like half the town.
Yeah, and they still came up empty-handed. So, we have a couple main suspects, and you'll have to tell me at the end which you think is the most likely.
Okay. But
these all sound pretty unlikely to me, in all honesty. We have a University of Arkansas freshman who later committed suicide in 1948, an escaped German prisoner of war, and an LA resident who believed he may have committed the crimes while he was in a coma. Which, that does not make any sense.
I'm sad this face doesn't transfer over.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, well, those are bizarre.
Yep. So, the Texas Ranger captain, he believed him and his men were dealing with a, quote, shrewd criminal who had left no stone unturned to conceal his identity and activities, and that they found both his efforts clever and baffling. Which, yeah. He believed that the culprit would go to any length to avoid capture. So, we're going to talk about a psychologist briefly, because this is why I think that Katie and them were part of it, because it makes a lot of sense to me. So there's a psychologist from the Texarkana Federal Correction Institute, who was Dr. Anthony LaPella. He believed the killer had deviated from the deserted back roads to the farm of Mr. and Mrs. Starks because he knew the roads were being patrolled. He believed that the killer was between 30 and 50 years old, motivated by a strong sex drive, and was a sadist. He was clever, intelligent, and shrewd, and that those are the types that are rarely captured. Which.
Yeah, I mean, you don't hear about, there's a dumb, like, lives in the moment, doesn't plan ahead criminal that evaded capture for you. That doesn't happen.
Yeah, so he believed that the culprit was not a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde type, but one that could pass as an ordinary, upstanding citizen. Likely not a veteran, though. He believed that the killer willingly left due to increased difficulty in committing the crimes successfully, rather than out of fear of the growing police presence.
Hmm.
Like, he just went on and did something else.
Well, yeah, I mean, when they literally have every gun in the town pointed outside at all times.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you've taken all the fun out of it for him, right?
A little bit. Well, it made it a lot harder anyway.
Yeah. So LaPella said, quote, "This man is extremely dangerous. He works alone, and no one knows what he's doing because he tells no one," and that the killer likely believed that the only way to remain unidentified was to kill all persons at the scene, and he did not believe that the killer was an African-American man like our first pair did. Although, he was kind of dick about how he said it. He said he didn't believe that the killer could be African-American because that type of criminal was generally, quote, "not that clever," which is a pretty shitbag thing to say. I mean,
it's the 20s or the 40s or.
That doesn't make it okay.
No, but I mean that, yeah.
Yeah. But here's who I think did it, because the evidence is pretty strong. And I feel like the locals probably had the best beat on this. So the locals, they had their own suspect in mind. And his name was Yule Swinney. He was arrested in 1947 for auto theft, and even his wife confessed that she believed he could be the killer.
Okay, I mean, like, if the whole town thinks you did it, what are the Rangers doing over there?
Yeah. So, Max Tackett, who we already talked about, he was a 33-year-old Arkansas State Police officer, and at the time of the murders, he was a rookie. He realized that a car had been stolen on the night of one of the murders, and that a previously stolen car had been found abandoned. So on Friday, June 28th, 1946, Tackett found a car in a parking lot that had been reported as stolen. So he stakes out the car until someone came back to it and arrested a 21-year-old woman, Peggy Swinney. She said she had just gotten married in Shreveport, but that her husband was currently in Atlanta. Atlanta, Texas. I didn't know that was a thing.
I didn't either. It's not what I immediately jumped to.
No. And he was trying to sell another stolen car, which I was like, you gotta love honesty, right? She's like, dude, we just got married. My husband's selling stolen cars. Sorry.
Apparently the marriage wasn't going well.
So Homer Carter, he's the chief of police in Atlanta. He told Tackett that a man had tried selling a stolen car to one of his citizens. So Tackett asked the citizen if he would recognize the person who had tried to sell him the car. But the man said, like, no, like, there's no way I would recognize him. But Tackett realizes that the citizen himself has a pretty distinct appearance, which included cowboy hat and boots, which, I mean...
Is that distinct in Texas?
Maybe.
I mean, it makes you distinctly, like...
Maybe Atlanta's, like, not country. Maybe it's more city.
Okay.
I don't know. So he tells the citizen, you wouldn't recognize him, but I bet you he would recognize you. So he asks the guy if he would be willing to walk with him into a bunch of public places with the idea that the suspect would see the guy and try to avoid him.
That's kind of clever.
Yeah, it is. So on Saturday, Tackett walks into the Arkansas Motor Coach bus station on Front Street near Union Station with this cowboy hat, boot-wearing guy. And what do you know, the plan actually works.
Really?
Really. Tackett sees a guy run out the back of the building and chases after him and catches him on the fire escape. When Tackett caught the man on the fire escape, he said, please don't shoot me. To which Tackett replied, I'm not going to shoot you for stealing cars. And the guy goes, mister, don't play games with me. You want me for more than stealing cars.
Oh, that's like saying I didn't bury those bodies in the bus out back three stories down kind of thing.
Well, yeah, hold that. So, obviously, this man was Yule Swinney. So, Yule goes on to make some other unwise statements that don't really help with building his defense case here. When Yule was in the police car, he asked Chief Deputy Tillman Johnson, Mr. Johnson, what do you think you'll do to me for this? Will they give me the chair? Johnson responds with, you won't get that much. Maybe 5-10 years, they don't give you the electric chair for stealing cars. Swinney goes, Mr. Johnson, you got me for more than stealing cars.
Yeah, super weird.
Like, why would you say that, you dipshit? Like, I don't know if Miranda rights were a thing at that point, but, like, read them and follow them.
Just don't say anything.
Don't say anything. So the police questioned Peggy, and she confessed in great detail that she believed him to be the Phantom Killer and that he had killed Betty Jo Booker and Paul Martin. Her story changed in some of the details across the multiple confessions and conversations. But the police ultimately believed that she was withholding some facts due to fear of Swinney or fear of incriminating herself, which...
Yeah.
Yeah. So police were able to independently verify some of the details from Peggy's confessions, like locating victim's possessions in a location she said Yule had discarded it. There was a shirt with
her. How is that not enough immediately?
I don't know. Well, we'll find out. So, there was a shirt that had a laundry mark that they thought could be linked with the Starks case that was found in Swinney's possession, but they said the link wasn't certain, which I think it was pretty fucking certain, personally. So it was a khaki work shirt that they found in his rooms, and it had a laundry mark with the word Stark that you could read under blacklight.
Huh.
And it also had... Do I talk about it later? Yeah. Okay. There's some other evidence that points pretty fucking strongly that it probably belonged to Virgil. So Peggy's confessions, they are the most critical part of this whole case, but by law in 1946, Peggy could not be forced to testify against her husband, and she was considered an unreliable witness because it was her husband.
Oh.
Yeah. So, boo on that. Ewell was not arrested for the murder. Instead, they only had circumstantial evidence. So he was sent to prison as a habitual offender for car theft.
Mm-hmm.
And the habitual offender sentence was basically a plea bargain, even though the case files indicated no such agreement had been reached formally. Ewell was very concerned about being sentenced to death for the murders, so he agreed to not contest the habitual offender charge. And in fact, he tried to plead guilty even though the offender cases just required a jury trial.
Mm.
By the time of Virginia Carpenter's disappearance, he was already in prison, so they had to rule him out as definitively being the killer. And he went on to basically just be a chronic offender until 1973, when he passed away. Or no, he passed away in 1994, and there was never anything that hard and fast linked him into being a killer, which I still call bullshit on. Because there were a couple things that very clearly pointed in the favor of him as the phantom killer. So there was the car reported missing on the night of the Griffin/Moore murder. When a lawyer told Peggy her husband was being held for murder, she exclaimed, "How did they find out about it?"
Oh, jeez.
Peggy's whole family and Ewell's brother-in-law thought he was the killer.
Okay.
There was slag found, because remember...
Welder. Yeah.
There was slag found in the khaki work shirt that matches samples from Virgil Stark's welding shop.
Okay.
And he had previously owned a .32 Colt pistol that sold it in a craps game.
When did he sell it?
Exactly. So the conflicting parts are none of the prints matched his. Peggy recanted her confession.
Okay, but like fingerprinting in the
40s. Wasn't accurate, yeah.
Yeah, like that's dusting and then looking at it, right? Like, yeah.
But he did pass away in 94. So they could have...
Like maybe if he still had the originals,
yeah, and
things like that. But I also don't know how much... Like fingerprinting, to my understanding, has never been an exact science anyway. Kind of like the handwriting analysis stuff. Like, unless you have the digitals and all that, back then it was like a artistry, like, close enough kind of thing.
Yeah. But yeah, Peggy also recanted her confession, which, boo. And then there was kind of a creepy turn of events. In the year between 1999 and 2000, an anonymous woman contacted the surviving family members of the victims to, quote, apologize for what her father had done. The only problem with this is Ewell never had a daughter, or at least not one that was claimed to actually be his.
Hmm.
So that kind of points away from it. But yeah, there is... one other suspect who I touched on before, he was the university freshman. On November 5th, 1948, 18-year-old Henry Booker, his nickname was Duty Tennyson, he was found dead in bed at home in Fayetteville, Arkansas. The Washington County Sheriff, Bruce Kreider, he discovered Tennyson had purchased cyanide of mercury on November 3rd, stating he was going to use it as rat poison, and they found a note reading, "The opening to my box will be found in the following few lines. In a tube of paper is found, rolls on colors, and is dry and sound. The head removes, the tail will turn, and inside is the sheet you yearn. Two bees mean a lot when they're together. These clues should lead you to it. So this note was found inside a fountain pen marked BB for double broad nib. Poison was found on the cap. The note inside the pen contained clues to the combination of a lockbox, but the police weren't really in the mood to play games at this point, and they just forced the lockbox open.
Okay.
And so inside they found a Viewmaster that had several rolls of film up Mexico and a stack of papers. Under the stack of papers was a note confessing to the Texarkana killings. The note read, "To whom it may concern, this is my last word to you fine people, and you are fine. I want to thank you for all the trouble that you've gone to send me to college and bring me up. You have really been wonderful. My thanks to Ella Lee, Miss McGee, the owner of the house he was rooming in, for letting me stay with her during my college career, and to Belva Jo, Miss McGee's 12-year-old daughter, for putting up with me the way she did. She had to know, but I fell in love with her about a week ago." Gross. If she was older.
I like how you shot that like you just read it for the first time.
I did. I just copied it. Because I was tired last night, and so I just copied the note in, and I didn't really read it all. But if she was older, I would have asked her to marry me, but that would be impossible. Why did I take my own life? Well, when you committed two double murders, you would too. Yes, I did kill Betty Jo Booker and Paul Martin in the city park that night, and killed Mr. Starks and tried to get Mrs. Starks. You wouldn't have guessed it. I did it when Mother was either out or asleep, and no one saw me do it. For the guns, I disassembled them and discarded them in different places. When I am found, which has already been done, please give this typewriter to Craig, Tennyson's older brother, and tell him that I hope his child is a boy. It will help him in his work. Everything can go wherever you think it will do best, except the Viewmaster, which will go to Belva Jo. Please take my bankroll and give it to Daddy. I think it should go to him, and tell him I don't want the car now. Well, goodbye, everyone. See you sometime. If I make the grade, which will be hard for me to make. H.B. Tennyson. So, couple things about that.
Yeah.
So Tennyson's brothers, they both said it was impossible for their brother to have committed these crimes. He didn't know guns, didn't care for weapons, hunting, or shooting, and none of the guns he could have had access to matched the weapons used in the crimes. Also, his brother Craig hadn't taught him how to drive a car until the previous summer. So after the murders had already happened.
Uh-huh.
Ballistics and all other evidence actually ruled him out. So not really sure why he confessed to the murders.
I don't know either. Because like the one thing I was going to say was, like, all things aside, the marksmanship is impressive.
Yeah. And for someone who doesn't like weapons or anything to do with them.
I mean, like, shooting someone multiple times through a window.
Yeah.
At a distance to where you can't hear the gunshots if you're in the house, like, that's not just somebody who knows guns. Like, they have to be fairly decent at it,
too. Yeah. Well, and so the psychologist who did it, the profiling for it, he did not believe, again, that this person was a veteran, especially of the armed forces, because he said there were none of the tells that went along with it. Which makes me think it was either someone who...
Well, it's also Texas, right?
Like, yeah, I mean, it was someone who either was obviously very familiar with guns because maybe they worked on a farm, they did hunting, maybe they just, you know, liked doing the marksmanship side of it. But either way, it was someone who did things with guns. Like, they were experienced with what they did. No one gets that many just lucky shots.
No.
But yeah, I said, like, other famous crimes, there's always false confessions. This is the one that you will get a chuckle out of. So Officer Johnson, he recorded a story about traveling to Shreveport after being notified by the Shreveport police that they had a man in custody for confessing to these murders. The man was arrested at a bar after unknowingly telling his story to a news reporter.
Oh.
Yeah, so the reporter promised the man a fifth of whiskey if he would do a tell-all.
Mm.
And so Johnson arrives, noticed the man was a Texarkana alcoholic who had confessed to the murders before.
Ah.
And so he calls the guy out by name and goes, "You know you didn't kill those people. What'd you go and do this for?" To which the drunk replies, "Well, hell, I got a fifth of whiskey out of it." So, long story short, I still want to go to Texas, but holy cow.
Maybe not that part of Texas.
Like I said, 70 years later, they still never found out who was responsible for all of these, and it's likely that they're, God, I hope so, long since dead, if and when they were, but I'm really curious if this is going to be one of those cold cases, like Jack the Ripper, that they just kind of keep in the back burner, and like 100 years from now, they find out who they was actually responsible.
Ugh, be nice.
Well, I mean, they did just find out, like, I think it was a barber that they finally are like, no, this was Jack the Ripper. Like,
oh, really?
They just came out with that in the last year or two.
I wonder what it was that, like, they discovered that, like, tipped that for him.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember. I had read about it, and obviously I have forgotten it.
Well, that's going to make all those Jack the Ripper board games pretty boring now.
Not when you play with me.
No, yes, you're a very good Jack the Ripper.
Okay, so... Yep, that is the Texarkana murders.
Okay, well, I'm really happy that Katie survived.
I'm really happy that Katie survived, yes.
I needed that positive note in my life. I think I'm on board with Yul Swinney being the guy.
Yeah.
Because that was a whole lot of... maybe there's some coincidence there. But also, what kind of person is his wife if... he did do those things, and she just didn't admit it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I get being afraid. Like, not confessing out of fear of what would happen to her. But it kind of sounds like, God, I hope they went their separate ways. But...
I don't know.
I mean, he was in prison quite a bit, so...
Hopefully.
No, he pretty much stayed in prison.
No, her, not him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, once she... That's something we probably have a definitive record of.
Yeah.
I'm glad Katie made it. I'm sad that they couldn't solve it, but...
Like I said, I'm holding out hope for it being like a Jack the Ripper, where they do eventually... Technology advances enough to find an answer.
Yeah. That'd be nice. That'd be good.
So, are you ready for a palate cleanser?
Sure. I've got one for you, too.
Oh, okay. Is it your joke?
No, it's not that joke. It's a different one. It is a dad joke, though. Okay. So it's unrelated, so you should go first.
Okay. I was offered a free meal at Texas Roadhouse and didn't take it. I realize now that was a mistake.
Oh.
How do crows in Texas greet each other?
How?
Yeehaw.
Good lord.
Okay, do yours.
I went to the zoo the other day. It was a terrible zoo. They only had one exhibit. It was a shih tzu. Yeah.
I feel like this is funnier if you're from Texas, but I'm going to read it anyway.
Okay.
What's the difference between a pigeon and a Texas oilman?
Hmm.
The pigeon can still put a deposit on a new Mercedes.
Okay, that's kind of funny, though. I actually like that one. That was a pretty good one.
Okay.
Yeah, you're going to lose fans in Texas, though.
I already said I'm not trying to shit on Texas. I'm just trying
that
to
find... That pigeon was, though. Look at that. And we're back.
I'm just trying to find jokes. If you have better Texas jokes, send them to us.
I do not. There's a lot of racist jokes when you Google Texas.
There's a lot of really mean ones, and I am purposefully scrolling past those.
We need some good, like, good fun Texas stuff.
Oh, I mean, this is accurate, though. In Texas, we don't measure temperatures in degrees. It's either hot as balls or cold as shit.
Yeah, that's fair. This week has been cold as shit.
Okay, I don't get this one, so explain it to me. Wanna know how to make Texans really mad? Cut Alaska in half so Texas becomes the third largest state.
Because they're the second largest state.
Oh, and Alaska's first?
Yeah. Okay. But if you cut Texas or Alaska in half, both halves would still be bigger than Texas.
Really?
Alaska's big.
God, holy cow.
Yeah, okay. Why do you think they keep filming Nat Geo shows up there?
All right, fair enough. Okay, you have to do your...
Okay.
This one's purely for Lauren, but...
This is for Lauren. Feel free to share it with the world if you want, but, you know, that's how it goes. What do you call a acapella band that covers post-apocalyptic songs, and the band is comprised entirely of knee surgeons? It's Acapaca Patella.
Guys, I'll have you know he laughs himself stupid over this joke.
Every single time. It's so clever.
It's so dumb.
It is dumb, but it's stupidly clever, and it makes me chuckle.
As long as it makes you happy.
Acapaca Patella. Oh, it's just fun to say.
I still like my Labracadabrador.
I know you do.
Yeah. But
mine's an original.
It is. All right. So... that's all we have for this week. Thanks for listening, and check back next Sunday for another episode. If you need some extra spookies, you can check our website at waittopanic.com, and I promise I will stop being lazy and put up some new stories on there. If you have any short stories you want to share, or general puns that you also love and would like us to read, please send them to us at waittopanicpodcast@gmail.com. And we will happily share any and all that you send us.
Give us some better ones about Texas.
Give us some better ones. Those are all so mean. Like,
we don't want to be mean. We like Texas.
They were so mean. And so many racist ones. You guys, we're so sorry.
Yeah, don't Google that.
Don't Google that. Anywho, make good choices. And remember,
wait to panic.